Hi everyone, and welcome to The Other Room. My name is Orelu Aleshi, or Ore as my friends and family call me. The Other Room is a podcast that features conversations with exceptional African women who are defining and redefining their roles in life. These are women who are charting their work and life journeys with purpose. We will look at their career trajectory, the challenges they have had along the way, and the things they have learned on the path to where they are now. I hope that my guest stories will help reaffirm that you are where you are meant to be, and if not, will encourage you to make important decisions about your next steps. Hi everyone, welcome! Can you believe that this is our 10th episode of The Other Room? Thank you all for your support by listening, subscribing, reviewing our episodes. I'm really thankful and really, really appreciative. So our guest today is Dr. Olayinka Akindayomi. She's a medical doctor working in community pediatrics and child development. She set up the Children's Developmental Center in Lagos, Nigeria over 20 years ago after her son was diagnosed with autism. The center provides high-quality early intervention programs for young people living with developmental and intellectual disabilities. Welcome, doctor. So welcome, doctor. Nice to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Lovely. So let's start with your childhood. Can you tell me about where you grew up? What kind of girl were you?
I wasn't a girl. I was a tomboy, more or less. Okay. I grew up in London. I was born in South Lambeth, but I lived mainly in Surrey, Redhill, Surrey, with my foster parents. I had two foster parents, families. The first ones lived in Margate, which is also Surrey, and then the last set lived in Redhill, Surrey. So that's where I was born, and that's how I grew up in those areas. But I wasn't a little girl, I was more of a tomboy. I remember they used to get really wild with me because they'll put on a beautiful dress, and by the time I come back in the evening, the dress is torn, and I have all this hay in my hair. And you know, African hair and hay was not easy, so they have to sit down for hours picking out all the grass in my hair. So I was a bit of a tomboy.
Oh, okay.
More than a girl, climbing trees.
Running around.
Yeah, that was me.
So how many years did you spend in England, and when did you move back to Nigeria?
The first time as a child, I came back to Nigeria when I was 10.
Okay.
So I came back in the 60s. And then the second time I did a stint as an adult, and I lived for about 3 years as well.
Okay. So where were your parents?
My parents were in London. They were in England. You know, in those days when Nigerians used to go abroad, they went for the Golden Fleece. They went to the university. My father went to law school, and my mom, she went to nursing school. So obviously they couldn't bring up, because I have another sister and a brother that were with me in London at the same time. And in those days, you couldn't bring up your kids, so you'd send them to a foster family. So my brother and my sister were one set of parents, foster parents, and I was with another set of foster parents.
I see. Yeah. Did you get to see each other very often?
No, I never saw my brother and my sister until we moved to London with my parents. And we didn't get to see my parents very often. In fact, I didn't even know my parents.
Wow.
I remember there was a story. My mom used to tell me a story with that. She had dropped me with my first set of foster parents for about 3 years. And when they came back to come and visit, I went to my foster mother and said, "Who are those black people in the sitting room?" And my mother burst out crying.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, that has had an impact on my own life in the way in which I brought up my own children. I never let them out of my sight.
Mm.
You know, they never went to boarding school or anything like that. They were always with me. And it was mainly because of the initial experience I had in my childhood.
Okay, so I take it that your foster parents were not black.
No, they were white. White.
So what was that experience like?
I think, you know, when I remember, I was very fortunate in the 60s that there was a lot of racism, but my foster parents were marvelous people, and I believe they taught me a lot about values, about myself, who I was. They never taught me that, oh, you're white or you're white inside. They always said, I must identify myself as who I am.
So at what age did you go back to your birth parents?
I went back to my birth parents when I was 10.
Oh, about 10,
yeah.
Okay.
But my foster parents, I went back to see them when I was as an adult.
Mm.
Yeah. But even then, you know, you say, oh, you know, you're still a child, but the impact had been made. And I think that was the reason why we didn't really bond well, because my sister and my brother were with another foster family.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had a sister who was in Nigeria with my grandmother, my mother's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was me.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow we really didn't gel until much, much later on in our lives.
Yeah.
And it's based on that experience that we had.
Yeah, that makes sense, because, I mean, you didn't grow up together as most siblings do. So you don't have that shared experience, memories. Yeah.
Nothing. So we have very different experiences.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So I'm also curious about how it was adjusting to being back with your birth parents when you were 10.
Oh, that was a tug of war. I'm sure my parents were very sad, particularly with me, because it was like every day, I want to go back to my mom. I want to go back. I don't want to stay here, because there was a difference in living in Surrey and then going to London.
Mm.
And this was SC22, so Dulwich.
Mm.
And in those days, when you talk about racism, it was at its peak.
Mm.
You know, everything was, you know, you're a black child, you got called nigger, you got called wog, you got called anything they could throw at you.
Wow.
And it wasn't systemic. It was very overt. It was in your face type of racism. I remember, even in Surrey, because I was the first black child to go to my primary school, they would tell me, you know, they would tell me that I shouldn't touch their party dresses because they would get all dirty. Dirty? I'm not dirty. Well, they said because I'm black, it would make it dirty. So, you know, those sort of things. And London was really bad. It was really bad. But it was like every day I used to cry that, you know, I want to go back. But somehow, you know, they had to tell me that, well, they are there, my parents, and there's no going back on this one. I think my mom, you know, was a bit, and my dad were a bit worried, because I could have run away. I know a number of times I told them that I'm going to run away, that I'm not going to stay. But I think invariably, somehow, I settled down, and it was even worse when we came to Nigeria, so that was a different story.
Okay, so tell us about coming back to Nigeria.
Coming back to Nigeria was really a culture shock in the 60s, because, you know, children then were still running around naked, you know, weren't wearing shoes.
Mm-hmm.
They had all these, you know, protruding tummies, and then you've got these kids that were brought up in London, and they were wearing slacks, and you couldn't wear slacks in those days because they'd stone you in the streets of Lagos. Yeah. And you get a whole trail of children, you know, jeering, laughing. So, you know, pretty backward stuff. And I remember, because we came on boats. Then they had the Oriel and their Papa.
Mm.
And it used to take 14 days from Liverpool.
Okay.
Not London, Liverpool. To Lagos, 14 days on the boat. Fun.
He landed, he got to Lagos.
He was like, God. You know, you're asking for chips and they're giving you yam. And we were terrible children. I mean, I was, my younger sister and brother, they were younger. So I was the leader of the pack. Mm-hmm. And it was like, this is not
this is not it.
And then you ask for cereal and there's nothing like cornflakes, you know.
But what was the impact of going from somewhere where you were looked down on because of your color of your skin and then moving to somewhere where everybody looked like you? What impact did that have on you?
I think what happened was that it had no impact. No? We would have gone back. I think the fish and chips were more important than the color of our skin at that time. That we were ready to go back. So that, terrible children. Children can be terrible. Really, really, really. I think that was, and I was meeting my elder sister for the first time. So that was a source of conflict because she felt she was the eldest and now I felt I was the eldest and there was a source of conflict. And it really had a great impact on our relationship for years.
Wow.
For years and years and years. But I'm very grateful to God that, maturity has really brought us together. So, but you can, people say they can tell.
Yes.
That there's a big difference between my elder sister and myself. You know, sisters, you know how it is. You get together, but you can tell there's a big difference.
What's the age difference between?
It's only 3 years, because the impact was there. But we make jest a lot of times, so we're more comfortable with each other now than we were when we were kids. When we were kids, it was awful. Fight. And you see, I'm the biggest.
Yeah.
So it was like, you can't tell me what to do because I'll beat you.
And then she wouldn't be used to that because, I mean, in Nigeria, it's all about respect, you know.
Yes.
Respect to elders. So
that would have been. So I guess she also had to grapple with that. I'm sure it wasn't easy for her too.
Yeah.
And to have that experience that you were left behind and it was only these three that ended up in England, I think that also had its own impact on her as well.
So when you were younger, so maybe let's say 10, 11, did you have an idea of the kind of life you wanted for yourself as an adult?
I think at 10, 11, all I knew, I was very creative. I've always been to draw this or to create that. I've been like that. I don't think I had a handle on anything when I was 10, 11. Mm-hmm. Everything was more of the influence, the European or the London influence was more play. Everything was more play. It was when I got to Nigeria that things were very structured. You know, you had to know your timetable. There, I didn't have to know my timetable. Here, you had to, know certain Bible passages and, wrote and memorize that. And if you're not, you were caned. And that was a new thing for me because I was never caned in England. And then you come home and somebody is beating the living daylights out of you with this long stick. I went to Ladilac at Yaba. So I did about a year there before I went to secondary school. And it was a completely different shape. But I've always been somebody who likes to create, who likes to draw and illustrate this. And the funny thing was that between 10 and 11, coming from an environment that taught me that I couldn't do anything, that I wouldn't amount to much, more than a sales girl or at most, at best, a teacher, which is okay. But and then coming into an environment like Nigeria that taught me that I could be anything I wanted to be. And that's why I'm always grateful to Nigeria, because I wouldn't be who I am if it hadn't been that my parents brought me back. And that's the truth.
Yeah.
As much as I feel, okay, London, that sort of environment where you could virtually do whatever you wanted to do. But in the 60s, you were not given that encouragement. Mm. Nigeria taught me that you could do whatever you wanted to do. So really and truly, 10, 11 wasn't when I was making up my mind as to what I really wanted to do. Mm. I think it was further down the road.
Okay.
When about 12, 13, once I got into secondary school, then I started thinking about, okay, what I really wanted to do. Mm.
That's why I was asking the question earlier about, you know, the impact of moving from England to Nigeria in terms of everybody looking like you. So,
okay. I guess that didn't dawn on me.
Then.
I mean, you're coming back to the culture shock. Now, we're living at Cole Street with my grandma in Surulere. Mm-hmm. And even then, electricity was a problem because then you're using these hurricane lamps, mm-hmm. kerosene lamps and all that. That was still, wasn't about electricity then.
Yeah.
And you're coming into that. It's a rude awakening.
Yeah.
So you're not thinking about that impact then you're thinking about all the goodies and your comfort in England.
I see.
Do you understand?
That makes sense.
Uh-huh. Then when my mom saw that we weren't doing very well with my grandma's, we then went to live in the barracks with a family friend, and they had a much larger house,
mm-hmm.
and they were more cosmopolitan, so they had conflicts, and so we settled down.
Mm-hmm.
Then we moved into our own flat, so we were getting used to the idea, and my mom kept on saying, "We're not going back, you're not going back. This is where you live now, this is where you live now, you're not going back." So I guess as children, after some time, well, no passport, no nothing, here we are, then you better deal with it. So growing up in Nigeria, I think has given me a lot of strength in the sense that it structured me, because I'm not a structured person, even now, I'm not very structured, but Nigeria structured me, and then I started, you can think about the things that you can achieve, the things you want to do. So that's what Nigeria gave me. Which is really very important.
That's good.
Yeah, that's what Nigeria gave me.
So then you now started thinking about, I guess when you were in secondary school, I guess then it was form one, form two, form three. So mm-hmm. maybe about form three, form four, you started thinking about your careers.
I think even earlier than that, I started thinking about, okay, I wanted to get into science.
Mm.
So science was important to me, right? And there again, I give that to my mother because even in England, you know, that Nigerianness, oh, how you're going to read this. And my mom used to buy me all these books, how and why books. So I had all sorts of things about space, about chemistry, about the human body, about all those things. So a long time ago, she has started exposing me to science. And I was very interested in those subjects. Coming to Nigeria, maths wasn't my cup of tea at all. But I'm still interested in science, in art, anything that biology, those sort of things, chemistry. And then I realized that, okay, yes, maths, but I could use biology, chemistry. I think it's biology, chemistry, physics.
Mm.
Maths. Those are the things that you needed to have to do medicine.
Mm.
So I started thinking about what I really wanted to do. The first thing that came to mind, that biochemistry. But then when I looked at biochemistry and all the things that you needed to do for biochemistry were the same things you needed for medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was a nurse, then that's when I started gravitating to medicine.
Right.
Yeah. In those days, there was a Federal School of Science. Before it became Federal School of Arts and Science, and then all of a sudden the whole thing went down. So the annex where King's College, that's where Federal School of Science was, and it was a fantastic place.
Mm.
Fantastic place. So I did my GCE there. I had already done school, so I passed school, so, but I didn't have, my physics and my maths were a bit low. So in order to beef those up, I went to do GCE there, GCE levels. And that's where I was able to also apply for prelim medicine.
Okay.
Because they had prelim medicine in those days. I don't know what it's like now, but we had prelim medicine in those days. So that's where...
Okay. What's prelim medicine?
Prelim medicine, it's a course before you go into College of Medicine. So in those days, it's either you do your 2 years A-levels, mm-hmm. or you cut and do prelim medicine.
Oh, okay.
After that year, you can then go to the medical school.
Oh, I see.
So that's
see,
how it used to be in those days.
Okay, okay, okay.
So
okay.
If you were clever enough, I think my own was pure luck. But if you were lucky, clever enough, because we only had 5 universities in those days. So if you were clever enough to do prelim medicine, prelim engineering, and prelim science. So you could cut out your A-levels.
Oh,
but it was very competitive.
Mm.
And there were only 5 universities. Mm. So you can imagine how many people. But fortunately, I got in. I think when I was in my year two. Mm. I don't know where I got the idea from, but I decided that medicine was too long a course not to start thinking about who you're going to settle down with. And I didn't want a situation whereby, because I had seen in front of me, there were many young ladies in front of us that had graduated and everything, and they weren't married.
Mm-hmm.
So I had decided that, look, if I find somebody, I'm going to get married before I finish. And my intended, as they say, came across. And he was busy saying, you know what, you know, you need to finish. And I said, I'm not going to finish before getting married. So he said, you know, what will your mom say? You know, people will think that he's trying to destroy my life. And I said, well, it's my life and I can decide on what I want. This is the English part of me now. And I can decide on what I want. So, lo and behold, in my part two, I was pregnant, and I was going to get married.
Mm.
So I couldn't think about career then. But I've also believed in one thing, having your cake and eating it. So that was the way it was. My mom wasn't very happy because she felt, would this be the end of her daughter's medical career,
mm-hmm.
because she felt, oh, who does this? My mom-in-law was up in arms because that this young girl, that she wants to have a baby, she wants to do medicine, she's going to do it. But somehow, or as I said, I think it's the adventure and the tomboy in me that, you know, You can do what you want, provided you're taking responsibilities for yourself. So that's how I had my daughter in part two, got married in part two,
wow.
Passed my exams, which is the second MB, to go to part three.
Wow. Wow. So how did you cope with new marriage, pregnancy, then baby, and then a very demanding school workload?
Again, I think this is just me being me. And God has, if they say there's no God, it's a lie, because I know that God has had a big hand in this matter. But I was very fortunate. My mom-in-law, my parents-in-law were very supportive. At the time, we were living behind their own house. And I would go to school, they would look after baby, come back, do some chores, cook, keep my husband, eat, read, and go back to school the following day. But if we have exams, then I stay on campus. That was the only thing.
Wow.
And that is what I did throughout 3 years, 4 years. Because it was tough. It was not easy because my house job, that's when I even had my, before my house job, I had my second child.
Wow. Oh, that's awesome. So then you started working and then, so what was that like?
It's a lot of, because unless you've got help, that's why, you know, my daughter was screaming at me, talking about her housekeeper and everything, and I was just looking at him. And when I was her age, I have three kids. One of them had autism, so he was about five kids in one. Mm. And I was working at County Hospital, and I was able to put all that together. No mother to cry on. Their mother-in-law is in Surulere. Leary. I was living in Ikeja, and I had all that. Mm. And even the house girls that we had at that time were very young. Mm. So, then you were allowed to do that sort of thing. Not like now, you're not allowed to do that. But they were much younger. And although they were part of the family, but they were just looking after the kids. So it was tough in those days too. But I don't know, somehow.
You did it.
I did it.
Yeah. So what was it like then having a child who was autistic? Like, how did you realize that he was autistic? Was it easy to diagnose?
In those days, this is the 80s now, mm-hmm. nobody knew about autism. And I just knew I had a queer child. That's all. He was really terrible. Feces on the wall, not sleeping, crying, cranky, very faddy about food and all that. So I knew that, yes, I had a problem here. Until he was diagnosed at the age of, I think he was diagnosed at the age of four or five.
In England. Years.
Yeah. Because they had told me when he was about three, somebody had given an unofficial diagnosis that they believe he's autistic, although they said, they were telling me it seems like it's mild because there's so many things he was able to do. Mm. Here, I remember Dr. What's his name now? Olayinka. Yeah. He couldn't make the diagnosis. He didn't know what it was. He felt that if there's anything, they gave it this minimal brain damage and a whole load of other diagnosis. But then I now took him to England, and that's where the diagnosis was made. And it was really difficult because autism was not well known in Nigeria. I had already two other kids, and he was a real pain. Mm. So that's when I took him to England for the 3 years to find out, okay, what do I do about this? How can I build on this? And what sort of help does he need? So we split the family into two. I went off to England, and my other two children, my other two daughters were in Nigeria here. One was actually 6 months at the time.
Wow. So he's a middle child.
Yeah.
Mm. So you stopped working, obviously.
While I was in England, I stopped working, but I went back to school because that was my best bet, that if I had to come back, mm-hmm. then it would be better if I came back, you know, more educated. Nigeria likes degrees, so if you get another degree and everything, then it helps. Mm-hmm. And then I also had to learn about autism, really learn about autism and what to do, how to take care of him.
Yeah.
And think about, okay, if I came back, what sort of thing could I also do to help others, not just my own child? So, because in helping others, I was helping my son.
But that's amazing that you had already started thinking about that, because I mean, Nigeria is a place where there's so much that's hush hush, and for a doctor not to be able to diagnose autism back then must mean that either no one was presenting children with autism, or they were, but it was just, you know,
they were, but they didn't know what it was
at all.
So they were given all sorts of, like I said, they give it minimal brain hyper something. I remember we went to see a psychiatrist at Louvre at the time, and he really sealed the envelope that I was to give to the pediatrician. So I opened it, and because I wanted to know what was inside, how can you save things about my child that I wouldn't know? So we opened it, and if you see the four diagnoses that he gave, nothing but about autism. Mm-hmm. So I also feel that the medical field at that time in Nigeria didn't really know much about autism.
Right.
And the fact that even when we were in medical school, I think I saw just one child that was autistic, and they said, oh, we shouldn't worry about that because most Nigerian children don't get autism. And here was I with a son
who
was autistic.
Right.
Yeah.
So then you moved to England, and then, so you were going to school during the day, and then, what was your son doing? Was he having
treatment?
He was
at school, he was, you know, we put him in school. That was where the Britishness came back, because then, you know, he's British, so it was easy to get back into the system to seek help for him.
Mm.
Which also wasn't very easy, because I think, although I was, again, there was a lot of luck on my side, because we moved into an area whereby there was a very good school, so he was immediately, I think within a week, he was already in school. They would drop him at 4 in the afternoon, so, you know, I could have some time to do some things. I had my place where I stayed, you know, and then thinking about, okay, so if, I think my husband's idea was for me to stay 6 months in England, which ended up being 3 years.
And okay, so then you moved back. Why did you decide to move back?
Pressure. And I felt that, you know, people were asking me at that time, that why don't you tell your husband to come back? But he was very successful here. He was doing, he was doing projects that...
What does he do?
He's an engineer, mechanical engineer. So obviously he was doing projects, and he was quite successful. And I didn't want a situation whereby you force a man to come over and he doesn't do so well, and things begin to fall apart. So I decided that, okay, if he could buy everything that we needed for my son to survive, then I'll come home. So he bought everything and we shipped everything down, and I came home. But I also had two other kids.
Yeah.
And my marriage was about 10 years at the time, so it wasn't a young marriage. It was already 10 years, and you don't want to throw that away.
Of course, of course. Okay, so then you moved back to Nigeria, and did you have any thoughts about what you might do in terms of work? Maybe go back and practice as a doctor, or...
I think one of the things that I got asked when I came back was, oh, didn't you want to be a consultant? That... you know, why not do a residency program? And I said no, because I'm not into academics, I'm not. And I can't stand exams, I rarely pass them. I pass them, you know, I don't know how I did medicine, to be honest. I passed out, but I'm not somebody who is into the exam thing, especially in Nigeria, because there's every likelihood that you will fail. So, and I don't need that, I don't need the stress. But having done my postgraduate in London, I had already made up my mind that the best thing would be is to set up a developmental center when I come back. But, you know, it's easier said than done. And you're coming back, you've not worked, there's no money, and only your husband is there. But I began to put things together. And I remember doing a research, going to WHO offices here, and asking them about what they did with children with disabilities, and them saying that, you know, the government is not really interested in that aspect. And because of that, they just focus on what the government says is important to them. So I was really angry because there was certain, because I was meeting many more parents that had kids with disabilities. But again, I'm coming back in the early 90s, and there were very few parents that were ready to talk about their kid with disabilities. So I bailed the cat. I started talking. My parents-in-law weren't worried about what I was saying, going on TV and having news articles and doing all the rest of it. And but I remember I used to get really nasty feedback. People would say that, Why are you washing your dirty linen in public? Why are you doing that? Isn't it a shame on your family? Excuse me, that you have a child with a disability and all that. So it was hard then, but I never, you know, it's okay. That's your problem. Mm. That's not my problem.
Mm.
And that's how I began to push it forward, gradually. And I'm glad I did that, because when I look at that and I look at the families that have come out now, sometimes they don't realize that there was somebody in front that opened that gap.
Yep.
For them.
I think you're talking about, you really normalized it. So what was, you know, considered shameful back then, you know, now is like, it's commonplace. Yeah. Like, that's my child.
Yeah,
that's my child.
But then, you, I say them not because I want to show off, but I want to encourage other people that as a woman, you know, as a woman, anything that goes wrong with your children is you.
Mm-hmm.
It's you. Your children are not clever enough. It's you. Your children don't do this. It's you. The moment the children are excelling, it's the father. The father has done this. The father has done well. And what I am saying is that when you have a kid with special needs, it's the father and mother. And if you have a boy, the boy takes his Y chromosome from the father. So why can't the father be responsible? And I think that well-behaving also helped my husband, because when I see my husband and his own relationship with his son, it's marvelous. I just love. You know, he was telling me something about on Sunday, because Akinyele went to Ebele's place, so he wasn't with us over the weekend. And he was telling me he went to the shops. And when he went to the shops, they were asking him, "Where's Aki? Where's Aki?" And he said, you know, they were sincerely asking for him.
Mm.
That, "Where's that your son? Where's your son? Where's your son? Why isn't he here with you?" And I said, "Do you know that Aki is so lucky that people know him?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "That is what is important for him. He might not be the rocket scientist or the great inventor or the professor, but people know him and they're asking about him, that, oh, where is he?"
Yeah.
And I said that, he said, yes, that he too, he felt very excited that they were asking that, "Where's Aki? Where's Aki? Where's Aki?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what were the early years of CDC like?
You gave me hypertension. Early years of CDC. Early years of CDC were an adventure, a real adventure. And the person that really helped me put things together was an African-American. She had just come into Nigeria to stay with her husband. At that time, there was this telecom called MTS.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband was one of the main engineers that was doing the MTS telecommunications. So she was looking for something to do, because she was dyslexic.
Mm-hmm.
Had 2 degrees and was trying to find out, okay, what could she do while she was here?
Mm-hmm.
So somehow CDC's name was in the American embassy. So she calls me up. We have made a date. And for 5 years, we worked together on this project.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, we were doing certain, having parent forums in her house. So I think every Thursday night we used to have parent forums. Parents would come, we'd talk about this, we'd talk about that. Didn't have any staff.
Mm.
And then gradually somebody gave us an apartment rent-free for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So that was not too far from her house. So we used to have services there, do assessments and things like that, just rudimentary stuff. And then a friend of mine gave me money, and I had some money. So we moved to Murutala Mohammed at Yaba.
Okay.
So we were there for about 4 years. That's when I started recruitment. So Beatrice and Shegu were part of that setup.
Wow, from then, okay.
From then. And then while I was there, we started having children, more children. I think I had about 14 children at the time. And one of those children, the mom, Mrs. Umar, she knew somebody in Lagos State. She knew the wife of Mrs. Marwa. Mm-hmm. And through Mrs. Marwa, we got this.
Nice. Wow, that's fantastic.
I'm telling you, somebody said, why not write?
Yeah, document the story of CDC.
CDC, your life and everything. I said I will.
Yeah, it's really important because this is really encouraging. I mean, right from the start of, in fact, everything you've told me so far, from your childhood, growing up, you know, with foster parents, mm-hmm. moving back to your parents, moving to Nigeria, medical school while married with, you know, mm-hmm. children. I mean, so much of what you have done has really bucked the norm. It's different. And
different.
I think that, you know, your life story is really something that can encourage, you know, so many, not just women, you know, but people in different situations.
That's true.
So you started the center and you've really been blessed in terms of relationships and people supporting, and it's been, that's been fantastic. But what have been some of the challenges in keeping the center running?
I think my main challenge, like I tell everybody, is money. I don't have any problems. Because even when I look at, okay, a lot of people talk about staff. And I think there is the way in which you treat people and what model do you set. If people can trust you, then you're bound to get people who will gravitate and stay with you. And that's something that I've learned. It's about the model. I look at Mr. Chevron, Beatrice, Ebele, and all these people. We are more than staff. We have a relationship going on. And we don't agree with everything. They don't agree with everything with me. Mm-hmm. But they see that I'm sincere. Any way I can help them, I will help them. Mm-hmm. And they know that. Any way they can help me, they will help me. It's more of, it's not so much of anti-mommy type relationship, but it's a real relationship. We understand this is this person. You take the good, the bad, the ugly with this person. Thank God my bad and ugly have been minimized. So you see mainly my good. If you see my bad and ugly, you don't want to be dealing with that. And I think that is what really makes an organization work. Yes, I understand the fact that some organizations are really very big.
Yeah.
And I don't want a big organization. I want an organization whereby the people are happy, we are happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that if you're going to excel, or you have dreams in your own life that you want to excel, you can all excel together.
Yeah. How has CDC evolved since you started in terms of the programs you offer, services?
It's evolved. CDC has really evolved because when we first started with 14 children, we looked at data. I think when we were doing the grant thing, when we looked at data, that we found out 4,000 plus families.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine how it evolved. Initially, it was just a more special education, and it was more the special education. But as more children started coming with different types of disabilities,
mm-hmm.
then we started adding on different services, different therapies,
mm-hmm.
sensory, occupational, physiotherapy. We started adding on things.
Mm-hmm.
As the children got older, then we had to upgrade services to meet the needs of older children.
Sure.
When my son couldn't get anything outside the center, that's when we started the adolescent and young adult services. Initially, it was just children.
Oh, I see.
But then children get older, nothing for my son. Then I took on his own therapy and services.
Okay.
And it's been fine doing that. Now, COVID has given us a different perspective about CDC. So CDC is on the path of evolving again,
mm-hmm.
so that we're going to have more of an online presence. We're going to make sure that the physical center itself continues, but we're going to now add our inclusive education. So we'll be working more with mainstream schools as opposed to a lot of the children being here.
Okay.
We'll still run the adult, adolescent and young adult unit, but now I feel we'll be more aggressive towards having community living, because that's the ultimate for them. And then the advocacy will continue. I think we'll still have the advocacy and all the other things that we want to do. But I believe that COVID is forcing us to have another face in the life of CDC, because it's not business as usual anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's community living?
Community living will be where the adults actually live, and they will go to work. They will still have their programs as well. So, and it will be more into, it will be more of the adults living in the community as opposed to living with their families. The adults have to become more independent, even if they're not solely independent, but at least they must become more independent and be part of the community, because that really is the main goal of CDC. It's not to keep people in an institution, but they're out in the community, because it's the best way to reduce stigma. Right. The other side of CDC is the product. So as you see all this coming, we are going to be more, do more products, weighted jackets, specialized seats for children that have physical disabilities. So I'm also going to try and get my daughter and her partner, who are product designers, to actually begin to look into products, because there's a market for it.
So CDC will start putting together products that parents can buy for their children.
For their children.
Special needs and disabilities.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. And then in terms of the community living, is that something that CDC would spearhead, or are there organizations that
Well, I've tried to, you know, my problem in this country is that you try to collaborate with others. It doesn't happen. So I might spearhead it and then have other people work alongside with me, or they join and then I can leave it to them, because one can't do everything. And that has been the bane of my life. I end up spearheading. I'm a promoter. I promote everything. And that's how I see it. You start, I start this, I start that. I'm not too good in finishing, but I start stuff. Especially if I see that there's a need for that particular service or product, or there's a need for it.
Yeah. So you've done a lot on your own and with CDC, you know, the organization, and then your army of supporters, you know, well-wishers. So how have you seen the government's role in terms of education, you know, awareness creation, advocacy for people with developmental disability evolve over the last, like, say, 20, 30 years?
Well, in order not to be all gloom and doom, obviously, as CDC evolved, the government also has evolved in this area. There's no doubt about it, because what was going on in the 80s is not what's going on now, but it's no near enough. And what I find is that where government, for me, I think one of the problems government has is not identifying key players that they can work with. I feel if they look for key players that they can work with and partner with, a lot more will be done. Because the people that are passionate are being maybe pushed aside, and the government is going on its own. But there were key players in the space before the government will come, and they should look at how do we harness those people and so that they can also move forward very quickly. So that's one of my issues with government. The other thing is that government, yes, government can, you know, play the issue that they too, they don't have money, but I'm not buying it. I believe that there should be funding set aside for this area because they are all citizens of Nigeria. And citizens of Nigeria or citizens of Lagos State should be looked after and cared for. And they are not asking you to just show pity and donate food and clothing to them. What they're saying is that if you structure a platform where they also are given opportunities, they can also add to the economy of this country, of the state. But where you go out and just handbag them with rice, this and that, obviously they're not going to get that opportunity. So there's a difference. CDC advocates for a platform of opportunities where they also can build up their own skills, be creative. Just like when we were talking about that Zero project, and we said that yes, we develop a program, but they are the ones driving the program through their own creativity, what they think is important, and how can we also help give them that opportunity. And I'm all for that because of the way people view developmental disabilities and disabilities. That's why we throw clothes and food and charity, but it's more than that. It's more than that.
What about in terms of policy? Lagos State passed special people's law. Can you tell us a bit about that and, you know,
how... I say I know about that, I'm lying, because one of the other things, you pass a law and then you don't disseminate it. I remember Lagos State has... I would say Lagos State is good in the sense that they try to build the cart in everything they do. So they are meant to be the center of excellence. So you'll find projects, you'll find policies and creativity, even within Lagos State. But its impact is not being felt. It was Fashola that put the Special People's Law together. Brilliant. There's a lot in that law, in those laws, that are not really very good, but okay, it's a document that can be worked on, work in progress. A couple of the things were that, okay, children with disabilities should get free education, free health, and free, but all children get that. What was the difference? That to me, there was no difference because all children should get that. There wasn't anything about inclusive education, for instance. There should have been something that says, okay, children with special needs should be considered for, you know, placement in regular schools with support, nothing like that. So there are issues, but at least it is there. There's a document. Yeah. Another thing was that 10% of your employees should have one disability or the other. But I sometimes find some of these things funny. Lagos State says that, but when you look at Alausa, how many people have disabilities? And if that is the case, what sort of access are you giving them? For instance, if you had somebody with visual impairment, are you putting them on the top floor or are you their office on the bottom floor? Are you making sure that things are written in Braille? and so on and so forth. If you have somebody with a physical disability, what about the ramps? As I said, they have evolved definitely, because people that I used to talk to in the past are not the sort of people that I'm talking to now.
Yeah.
They say different things.
Mm.
And you can see, and I think some of the officials in government also have kids with special needs. Although, again, that is another problem because they take them abroad.
How do you maintain self-care? Emotional, mental self-care? Because the work you do is really, really, it's demanding.
Yeah. And I think I make demands on myself. Okay. I wouldn't say I'm very athletic, because I'm not. Although, as I said, as a child, wow, climb trees, roll down hills, do all that. So I've always been somebody who is active, physically active.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a rule my foster parents had, that once you eat dinner in the evening, you cannot sit inside the house. You have to get out.
No.
Yeah, so you had to go run around the block. So those were certain things. So I was never really a fat child,
mm-hmm.
but I used to eat a lot. I love my food. But having said that, I think after my first child, I put on a lot of weight. I started exercising then, aerobics.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first people were at Palm Grove, Pamela's. When we all used to go to Pamela's, and I used to do aerobics. So that also helped stress as well. Well, on and off, I've been doing it. I used to swim.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done a stint of swimming. And then I went into cycling, so I used to ride bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And then from cycling, I went into dancing, you know, do dance
mm-hmm.
and all that. But I think over the last 2 years, the thing that has really kept me going, because I've now gone back into my childhood, is jumping rope and music.
Okay.
And I've gone into it totally. Even my husband's looking at me. One morning he had to look at me and said, there are very few women of your age that can do what you're doing presently, because I'm really jumping that way. Sometimes it takes its toll on my knees, but I mean, it's not as bad as it was when I was jumping. So for, let's say, a year and a half,
mm-hmm.
I've started real jump roping 20 minutes every day.
So what is next for you, and what's next for CDC?
Well, I think I've told you how CDC is evolving, so that's what's next for CDC. What next for CDC is what's next for me, I guess, but I don't intend to retire very soon. I believe I still have a lot of energy. I have my health, and I ask God for wisdom and courage to go through it, because one cannot just sit at home and say, okay, you know, one doesn't work anymore. However, that would not be easy for somebody who is young, saying this old woman who still wants to continue. But age is just a number, so I'm not looking at that. I just believe that one continues until they die, as much as possible. I'd like to be able to do a lot more training, because I feel I have skills, and I have a lot of, not just skills, but experiences, knowledge that I can share with others. Maybe they can learn something from me and my life and what I've been able to do with nothing. Because a lot of people think that when you start organizations, oh, you've got money. A lot of it is that you start with nothing and you build it up. A true entrepreneur is not somebody that complains about funding. A true entrepreneur is one that brings out creative ideas and begins to develop those ideas, and then thinks about, okay, so where do I get money from? But then finds out that money follows creativity. So I see myself continuing to do that. Just as you said, maybe it's very important for me to actually write a book. I've been toying with the ideas, but many things get in my way, so I might start and then stop. But maybe it's time for me to actually settle down and put something to paper. Look after my grandchildren. They don't see me enough. They think I'm not the ideal grandmother. Their ideal of a grandmother is somebody with glasses perched on their nose, you know, knitting at home. I told them that I'm very far from being like that. So, because it's a greedy. But the funny thing is that recently my eldest granddaughter, who's about 12 now, decided that she wants to run a business. So she's put a business together. She calls it Smoothies. Mm. And she has the menu, she has everything. And I told her that the next time I visit them, she should pitch her business to me if I'm to invest in it. So at least maybe some of the genes and DNAs are working in my grandchildren already. So,
Okay, then I was just thinking as you were talking, what are you thinking in terms of succession planning in CDC?
It is already happening. I mean, people have taken over the reins. I think, you see, when white man says succession planning, we should look at our culture and see how do you succession plan in accordance to the African. I think sometimes we get all these concepts and we don't realize that these concepts have come about from their own culture, their own way of doing things. And we immediately take those words and say, oh, succession planning. But what is succession planning in Yoruba, Igbo, Hausa? What does it really, truly mean to the African? So for me, what succession planning means is that, yes, you can still be running the business, but a lot more decisions are being made by other people. You can guide them, they can make their mistakes and tell them that they must take responsibility for that. But that doesn't mean that you're not in the picture. I mean, just this morning when I was telling people that, they were telling me, it's not now you're going anywhere. Because they just believe that, okay, if I'm here, I will bring up some ideas, I will do this. Have you looked at this? Have you looked at that? And I think that's what they need. It's not that they can't do certain things, but they just want you in the picture. So my succession planning is very different. It's not just about just one person. It's about a number of people who could, you know, because if you're a founder, when you're a founder, you've got many qualities. I think I got that right, qualities. You've got many qualities, many skills, and you're doing many, many things. And you're pushing all those many, many things forward. And you would find out that nobody can take that place of a founder. Nobody. Because you're a founder. So nobody can take it. But what happens is that people can take different aspects of your skills, of your knowledge of them. So if it's finances that you had to learn all along, you can give that to somebody and that person runs with it. If it's building up programs and developing programs, somebody else can help you do that. It might not just be one person. So succession planning for me is not just about giving power to one person or handing over power to one person. It is how do you continuously build up that organization that other people would also run with it. And I didn't get that from any book. That's I got from experience that this is the way you do it in Africa.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your story with me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I hope it was helpful, Chef.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me on The Other Room in conversation with Dr. Olayinka Akindayomi. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with Doctor. She has been challenging the status quo from day one. She shared how her adventurous spirit has propelled her forward in her family life and her work, especially with establishing and growing the Children's Developmental Center. If you enjoy this episode, please drop us a voice message saying the things that you liked about it. Also, give us a rating and review and subscribe to The Other Room. Until next time, live your life with boldness and joy.